Hello, friends, and welcome back to the show. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to tell you all about Shady Rays. Before I say anything else, let me say this. What I'm about to lay out is not a paid ad. For the longest time, I kept seeing these ads on social media for these sunglasses, polarized, just the right fit, and they looked cool as hell. Well, then I checked out their website and I ordered two pairs. I have got to tell you, these are the best sunglasses I've ever owned. Shady Rays is an independent sunglass company that focuses on one thing, making the best shades for living active and worry-free in the outdoors. These shades feature shatter-resistant, high-visibility, polarized lenses, and durable construction. And the Shady Rays team stands behind them with free replacements if you lose or break them and a lifetime craftsmanship warranty. I can testify to this. If you break a pair of glasses or you simply lose them like I do, just reach out. All you have to do is pay for shipping. They send you another pair. Unbelievable. And here's what's really cool, friends. They didn't want to settle for being a company that just sells sunglasses. They wanted to make a difference with each purchase. Through research and talking directly to their fans, the Shady Rays team found the cause that gives purpose to their work. In partnership with Feeding America, Shady Rays donates 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every single order. One pair of sunglasses equals 10 meals. Thanks to their loyal customers, Shady Rays has provided over 9.4 million meals, and they continue to donate thousands of meals every day through Feeding America-sponsored food banks across the country. Folks, everyone needs a good pair of sunglasses. Stop paying hundreds for them and go to this website right now. Go to ShadyRays.com and check out their fantastic sunglasses. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. ShadyRays.com, make that purchase, give your eyes a much-needed break this summer, and help Feed America 10 meals at a time. Emily, I appreciate you. Thank you for hanging out with me a little bit tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem at all. I mean, with the quarantine, where else am I going? So.
Right. Yeah, good point. So I discovered the show actually almost by accident, like I do with most of the shows I listen to. Mm-hmm. I know you've sort of been going through it for a while now, and everyone listening to this, I promise we'll get into it as much as we can tonight. But before we do, let's sort of start at the beginning. Give everyone sort of broad overview of the story, the one that you're covering in this particular podcast as you first learned of it.
So when I was 20 years old, I just turned 20, a young woman named Jalea Davis, who was from the same general area that I'm from, had just turned 20. I was actually living abroad, but Facebook and social media, you know how that connects all of us.
Sure.
So, you know, it was plastered all over social media come late November about this young woman, Jalea Davis, having been killed in a suspicious manner. Mm-hmm. And that the public in my area thought that there was some foul play and possibly a homicide. So that's how I came to know about it. I talked to a friend that following week or, you know, right around that time, who had actually been in a vehicle and hanging out with Jalea a week prior to her death.
Wow.
Right. So we had mutual friends. I never met Jalea Davis, but like I said, you know, same general age range and friend group type of thing.
Sure.
So over 6 years, I followed the Justice for Jalea Facebook page.
Yeah.
And would every once in a while, once every month, every 2 months, just check in and see if there was anything new on that. Mm. And actually, you know, I was looking back the other day and saw where I had commented on a picture several years ago. I think it was 2015. Mm. Right. It was a really odd scene. You know, it was a very graphic death and it was investigated as a possible homicide and ultimately ruled an accident.
Yeah.
So what I was doing with Mile Marker 181 was working with Jalea's mother, Kim, who had supplied me with all of the documents she had received via a FOIA request.
Yeah.
I spent several months going through just the documents and trying to figure out, you know, how I was going to get through all of that content, because we're working with over 700 pages, which is relatively small, but it's a lot to cover in a podcast.
So. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Going through pictures, interviewing people that had already been interviewed or hadn't been interviewed before, but had come forward later with something, you know, any lead essentially that I got, I was following up on.
So we have a little bit of a broad overview now for folks who might not know or who have not, might not have heard the show, but talk a little bit about your background, because I read a story about you working on a case at like 13 years old that story has like a Nancy Drew investigative feel to it. So just tell everybody about that.
Yeah. I was kind of in either the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time. So I was 13 years old. I had made a trip to the library, which was just up the street from my house. And I had noticed on my way into the library that a guy in a truck was like eyeballing me. And women know that eyeball.
Yeah.
Normally at 13 years old, you're not getting it from an adult man. Mm. But I was like, okay, you know, just kind of like the spidey senses already tingling. So I went into the library. I was looking around. You can't make this up, but ironically, I was actually in the corner of the library that had Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. Yes. That's little awesome. Foreshadowing there. Yeah. So I looked over, I noticed, you know, out of the corner of my eye that there was a gentleman standing there, and I looked over and noticed that he actually was exposing himself. So he had pulled himself out of his pants. And I just kind of thought in my head, like, all right, I'm just not going to react. I'm not going to like run away. I'm not going to scream or just give him any reaction, because that's probably what he wants.
Yeah.
So I just kind of continued to look at Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys for a minute, and then turned around and walked up to the counter there at the library. And it was super busy and nobody's paying attention to a 13-year-old kid. So I went to the library, like the librarian's office in the children's section, and told her, I was like, I need to talk to you.
Yeah.
So she immediately knew something was up. So they actually, Parkersburg police came and arrested the guy. He tried to plead not guilty, which is really stupid when you have three younger girls that are picking you out of a lineup of photos.
Yeah.
And you're in the place at the time that this is, you know, allegedly occurring.
Right.
So he ended up pleading guilty, and it actually came out later that he had been raping and exploiting his daughter in webcam like chat rooms.
Jesus.
For about 6 years. And I actually had the opportunity this week, a year ago, to meet his daughter and record with her for a future project.
Wow.
So
Jesus. Yes. Yeah. What a thing. Right. So that's an unfortunate backdrop to sort of what you would end up doing. But so here's the thing. We now live sort of in a society where people our age, I don't know, how old are you, by the way? I should ask.
I'll be 29 this year.
Oh, God, I feel so old. Okay. So so we live in a society now where, you know, people our age, or I guess, you know, your age and my age, just different, I guess, different times. But we've grown up with things like the first 48, you know, Forensic Files, Unsolved Mysteries for me and all the old dudes out there.
And me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Stack. Yeah.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I feel like there's a natural need or an evolution for people to want to sort of get involved in solving cases that they feel, you know, particularly drawn to in whatever manner that is. It becomes sort of like an obsession with them. For me, it was Amelia Earhart and that case and that disappearance all the way back in 1937. Yeah. Have you ever thought about why that evolution sort of exists now within our society and our culture?
It's one of those things that I've always had, like that curiosity. You know, my mom says, like, if I don't know everything, my head hurts.
Yeah.
But I, you know, as like an age range, as a society, I think humans tend to just want a reason. They want an explanation for everything. Like, we are naturally curious creatures.
Right.
And I think that when we don't have the answers, it just, there's like that void that we try to fill.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of what you get with conspiracy theories, or not necessarily conspiracy theories, but theories about what may or may not have happened. in a case. I think it's that natural human nature to, you know, things that we don't understand or things we don't know, we want to fill in that gap.
Yeah, that's a good summary of that. And like, I know you touched on kind of how you heard about the case for the first time, but when you heard it or when you heard about it, did something sort of click for you that made you think, okay, this is the story I think I can make a difference with. This is what I want to cover. This is where I want to go.
This happened 2011. I was only 20 at the time. I was a nanny in Germany. So I wasn't even living in the country, but I wouldn't even say right away, like being 20, you don't have the self-confidence to even maybe go out and do something like that or approach, you know, a victim's family. I was trying to learn German at the time and that was my obsession.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until, I'm trying to think even what year are we in now, 2020?
2020, yeah.
I guess it would have been around the end of 2017, beginning of 2018.
Yeah.
I actually started listening to My Favorite Murder at the beginning of 2018. And I was new to the medium of podcasting. It had never occurred to me that that was even like an option of something that I could do or start. And I mean, it was a while later, it was another 5 months before I actually took on this case.
Yeah.
But you start to wake up that part of your brain again, that kind of like sleuth part, that part where you want to know the answers. And I had actually read Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark when it came out. And I was thinking, you know, someone should write a book about the Jahlia Davis case and cover it in length and do what Michelle had done, you know, on her own investigation of Golden State Killer. But I, you know, and I was thinking, well, somebody should do that. Somebody should do that. Yeah. And then I finally was like, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, that's actually echoes what Mike said when he started talking about, you know, how Sword and Scale was sort of birthed and how, like you see, he started listening to all these or watching all these different shows. And he's like, there were no podcasts about kind of that same material. And so I decided to do it. It's obviously his is a more general podcast on true crime. This is a specific case, but you know, it's kind of the same concept, I think. It's just people get curious, people want to do it, and they think, okay, well, if no one's going to do it, then maybe I might as well be the one to do it.
Right. And I should say, so no one had covered this story at length. No one had covered this case, but Danielle Halon, I'm not sure how you say her last name, who has a true crime YouTube channel, she had actually done a coverage of this case, what I call like a drive-by. So where you do a one episode and done.
Right.
But she did a pretty good job. I mean, there's a couple things in there, you're always going to have that where you have like one or two little things that are maybe, you know, you say the wrong name or something, but she actually did a pretty good job of covering that. But it just, I felt like it needed a deeper dive where we really break like everything down.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like cases like this one, like the Jahlia Davis case, and there's a lot of others out there, of course, but I feel like the public is generally very sort of invested in these cases because there's such a need, as you'd mentioned earlier, there's such a need to find justice for the victim and the victim's family. But this one in particular has been even bigger than most. So, I mean, why do you think that is? Is it just kind of like, you know, the graphicness of potentially what happened and everything? I mean, why do you think this case in particular is sort of like really just kind of woken up everybody so much?
I think there's a couple reasons. And I think you were hitting that nail on the head there with part of it is, and it's funny because I actually used to steer clear of this type of graphicness.
Yeah.
Especially anything, you know, we all have those, like not even a phobia, but anything, you know, involving like decapitation, I was not about it at all.
Yeah.
So I actually had to kind of overcome that while working on this. But I think you're right. Some people are, I don't want to say into, but it is a very, maybe taboo is even the right word.
Yeah, sure.
With how graphic the scene was.
Yeah.
I think part of it is because Jahlia was, sort of a marginalized person. She is a person of color. She was mixed African-American and Caucasian in an area where we are predominantly Caucasian.
Yeah.
So you're also dealing with that possibly playing a role in the investigation or maybe how it was handled. And then you've got the other side where you look at the people that are being accused or implicated in this, and you've got three people that are all relatives or of current or former law enforcement.
Yeah.
So you've got a sheriff's department investigating this death as a possible homicide, which I feel like that's important to say. It wasn't investigated as a homicide. It was a possible homicide.
Right.
A traffic fatality. And then you've got the main person being accused or named, and all these rumors flying around, is the former sheriff's granddaughter.
Yeah.
So of the very same agency that's investigating it. So I think for a lot of people, that's the real one there. That's like the extra mile that people are going, okay, hold on, wait a minute.
Yeah. And so in the name of the show, obviously Mile Marker 181, it's an interesting name. And I think I know why you picked that, but for those who may not know, for those who may not have heard the show yet, or will listen to the show after this piece, how did the name come about? How did the name come about for you? And why'd you go with that particular title? Because it is catching for a podcast.
Thank you. I don't know how I cooked that up.
Yeah.
But it was the only idea that ever came to my head. Literally the only one.
Yeah.
So I kind of tentatively named it Mile Marker 181. I guess I should maybe give myself some credit for that.
Yeah.
And you know, I told Kim the name I had planned, and she said she loved it.
Yeah.
So, and I think it's kind of like vague enough. It's what happened at that spot.
Yeah.
That's the mystery, is, you know, and especially if you're from the area or you've been driving through that patch on I-77, you know, it's a bit isolated. It's not too far outside of town, but it's in a curve. It's in a very dark spot.
Yeah.
So I feel like that spot in the road already is a bit, I don't want to say spooky, but for lack of better words.
Right.
So it's a bit mysterious already.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like every time I have a podcaster on the show, and I've had, you know, we've only done a handful of shows so far, but the majority has been with, you know, various podcasters and things. But I asked them about something I think is really important: show structure. And I do that because almost every show is structured a little bit differently. But when you first sort of made the choice to cover the case, did you have to sit down and write out any kind of overview to give yourself an idea of what you wanted? Did you know what you wanted? Did you know how you wanted it to kind of sound? What was your thought process behind structure for the show?
So as I'm trying to remember if I had listened to Serial before or during my research for this, but I liked the format, and I liked kind of the flow of that.
Right.
But what I actually did was I had this wall in my former apartment, and I put up all of these not post-it notes, but note cards.
Yeah.
And I had written out, I was just like spitballing, like, okay, these are the things I think are important. Like we've got to cover like specific alibis. We've got to cover the keychain, which actually I still have to incorporate that a bit.
Yeah.
But you know, specific things that I thought deserved to be covered and have their own episode.
Right.
And sometimes I was stacking those in an episode together as I got rolling through season one.
Yeah.
But they were all topics I wanted to address. And you know, one of them that will actually be coming out still is an interview I did with a crash reconstructionist who really didn't take a look at this case specifically, but, you know, I had interviewed him to get an idea of what the typical procedure is when you come up on a traffic fatality.
Yeah.
And how you reconstruct the scene, and, you know, what the step-by-step is. Okay, when you arrive on the scene, what do you do?
Yeah.
So I was going through the case files and writing out note cards. And I wanted to, that's why some episodes and are so long and some are so short.
Yeah.
Is because I try to do it by topic or by day of the investigation. So in the case log, I would, okay, all these things happened on this day. Let's throw that together.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that's something similar that I do with Vanished and what we're doing now. We did the Earhart thing, and we're getting into the John Wilkes Booth thing. And I'm doing a lot of note cards and a lot of different things. And just kind of throwing things up in front of me and just kind of trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to cover? How much time are we going to dedicate to one aspect of a case? You know, how are we going to do all this? And I think it's important to kind of talk about that because, you know, people think they can just start recording on a microphone. And I'm sure, yeah, you can do that. But it's just structure and story and everything. That's what kind of keeps the listener engaged. Because at the end of the day, you are trying to get ears, you know, on the podcast so people can get, you know, ears on the case and can listen to it and all that. So it's a fine line.
Yeah. And I know that while I was So the first time I read through the case file, I just had a highlighter in my hand and read through it like back to back. Like I have a massive 3-ring binder that it sits in. And I would sit on my couch, and my ex at the time, he was just like watching, you know, Alton Brown or something. And I'm with a highlighter, like going through that book. And then on the second time through the book is when I actually started making notes.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I'm like a diligent note taker and, I make a lot of lists. So I would kind of make list per episode of exactly what needed to be covered as well.
You know, that's interesting. That's actually what I do with authors. We have authors on the show, and we did this for season one, and then for Chasing Earhart, and then now with Booth. But like, I'll typically read an author's book twice. So like the first time I'll read it, you know, I won't take any notes or anything. I'll just read it to consume it. And then after that, I'll go through and I'll actually like skim through the whole thing and read most of the chapters and take notes on it.
Right.
Especially when I'm going to interview them, because I want to, you know, ask some specific questions and everything. So it's interesting that you do that.
Yeah.
Now you said on your very own show, you're not an investigator, you're not a police officer, but people seem to like that, I think, because shows like yours, shows like Up and Vanity.
Do they?
I think so, because, well, at least podcasting community, I mean, we'll get into it a little bit, of course, like there's ups and downs, of course, but I think what attracts, you know, people to shows like yours and other shows, like Up and Vanish was a great example. When he did the first season, it's like he wasn't, you know, wasn't a police officer or investigator. He was just sort of like a podcaster. He just wanted to kind of investigate this case.
Sure. But
all of those, you know, shows are successful, I think, in part because of that factor. Because it's almost always someone that's maybe not a professional investigator at the center of those shows, maybe working hand in hand with one or whatever the case is. But did that factor ever like concern you, or did it weigh heavy on you while you're dealing with the family and the authorities and all these things? Like the deeper you got into this, you know, the idea that, you know, you're kind of, this is like your first kind of go around on this, working on this case, and you're obviously very in you know, passionate about it, and you're very concerned about it. But did that bother you at all? Just the idea that, you know, like, right. Hey, I'm, you know, I felt like that with Earhart. Like, to be honest with you, like I started talking to forensic anthropologists and archaeologists and, you know, crash investigators and all these people that work in it for 20, 30, 40 years in some case. And I thought, there were certain points where I would even tell my wife, like, I'm in over my head at this point, because I feel like I'm just like, I can't even understand some of the things that some of these people are telling me, and I'm supposed to interpret this for an audience. Like, that's must be tough.
There were certain aspects where I definitely was like, oh crap.
Yeah.
One of those things was the cell phone data, the cell phone tower information. So yes, there were maps on that, but they aren't like your average map. Like, there's no real like index of what you're looking at.
Yeah.
So I actually had somebody who was former military teach me how to read all of that. Mm. So an odd thing I can add to my resume now, but I think yes and no, there were definitely moments where I was kind of like swimming in information.
Yeah.
But I think what I tried to keep in mind doing this, and part of the reason that I had so much success getting people to talk to me locally is because I am a local. I think that maybe that's part of the reason that people, the people that do enjoy the podcast, enjoy it, is because it's a local. It's not an outside person that's done this in true crime before, or a trained investigator or journalist. It's a woman that was the same exact age that could have been me, that could have been my friends. Which is really why I was so driven to cover it and investigate it.
Yeah.
Is because it's like you put your friend, you know, my friend who was in the car with her that week prior, like that could have been her on the interstate.
Yeah.
So I tried to keep that in mind while I was doing it. And I think maybe I have a knack for getting people to do that, at least locally. So I tried to keep in mind, you know, like, I'm a local doing this. People are more, especially in Appalachia, we operate just a little bit differently, I think. And that's not a bad thing. We're just, I know that Appalachians, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but Appalachians are a little hesitant of outsiders. And rightfully so, because we seem to get screwed over consistently. So I think that actually served me well. So there were times where I felt like I was swamped with information or like content, actually, like so much of it, but as far as approaching people and doing cold calls, like I never really felt that intimidated by that.
And so you touched on earlier, you mentioned your binder, the binder full of case information, preparing for the show. I read an article online, at the top of the article, it's got this photo of you. Of course, I'm sure you know, with this big ass binder all tabbed up. And it reminded me of, again, the Earhart case. So I felt like an instant connection to that. So I guess that leads me to sort of gathering the gathering of information. Let's talk about sort of where you touched on it earlier, but where you started gathering. Tell me about that whole process for you. I know Kim helped you out, giving you some of the stuff that she had, but how did you gather everything together to kind of take a serious look at this?
Really, it was Kim. I had reached out to Kim, and within a week, she gave me everything.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about there are photos that the family has not looked at that I was looking at while I was working on this. So she was, you know what I mean? She was totally cooperative and basically gave me everything on a thumb drive. And I went to Office Depot and had it all printed off and threw it in a binder that day. So the bulk of it came that way. I was also doing a lot of like kind of online sleuthing with things that had been posted online by people who had been accused, looking at what they were up to now, looking at what had been written. I stayed off of Reddit, but there was another forum I looked at. Yeah, I didn't want Reddit in my brain at all. And thank God for that. I need to adopt that policy now too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I basically was just like reaching out to anybody that I could think that would be beneficial to talk to again.
Yeah.
Or there was, at one point, if you've listened to all of the first season, a young woman that I call Anna, that she had reached out to Kim, and I had then reached out to Anna. To interview her, and actually ended up at her house and everything.
Wow.
So, right. You know, talking about something that may have been said, by one of the named people's mother. I would say like 70% of it was the book, what I call the book, which was supplied by Kim.
Yeah.
And then maybe 30% of it was my own investigative online sleuthing, talking to people, approaching people in person, all of that.
In that process, what information did you come across when you first started looking at this, or even as you got further into the case, but what information surprised you the most, do you think?
That's a really good question.
Was there something that stood out for you that just kind of like, and we'll get to sort of kind of, you know, where you stand now in the case and kind of what your opinions are on it. But I mean, as far as just kind of as you're starting to kind of gather all this information, was there one fact maybe that stood out to you that like, oh, that's interesting, or that's weird, or I wonder why that wasn't investigated?
Sure. And it's still the keychain. It's still that keychain issue. So the fact that one of the last people with Julia was in possession of a keychain that normally was attached to Julia's wristlet, like what she carried her keys with.
Yeah.
And the Davis family was able to eventually get it back via that person's attorney. So, you know, she gave it to her attorney and the attorney handed it to the lead investigator. The lead investigator got it back to the family. And that I was just talking to a friend who's actually a city cop about that last night. And I was saying, that's the only thing that I'm like, I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very minute thing. I mean, that's not actually, if there was physical evidence to be backing something up, that could be good circumstantial on top of that. But it's definitely not incriminating enough to really, it doesn't have any traction, but it is very odd.
Well, and speaking of that, that's a good segue. So there's two largely competing theories, and there's sort of like sub ideas and things underneath some of these theories, but like there's two largely different ideas, I guess, we'll just call it that, on sort of what happened that night in this investigation. Can you sort of summarize what those are? I mean, it was either an accident or it was foul play, right? I mean, so can you kind of get into a little bit of maybe a little more meat and potatoes of what those are?
Yes. So the accident is pretty clear cut, right? That's that's the fastest one to work through, is that the fact of the matter is Julia was intoxicated. Her vitreous fluid, which they obtain obviously postmortem, it gives you the most accurate reading on blood alcohol content. And that was a 0.24.
Yeah. Wow.
So, right. So, a substantial amount of alcohol had been consumed, and essentially that she crashed her vehicle. Some people call it the black box, but it's the event data recorder in the vehicle, showed that she was not seatbelted in. Now, the passenger, and this is important to clarify because a lot of people like to argue this the opposite way, and I've been one of those people. The passenger side seatbelt, like the indicator, was broken prior to this accident. It's important to keep in mind that this was a reconstructed title on the car. The car had been totaled. It had hit a deer the year prior, or maybe 2 years prior to Jalea owning the vehicle. So we're dealing with a vehicle, and I know the car lot that it came from, and knowing that information, I also have some feelings on that. You know, the accident, essentially what was the final conclusion on the sheriff's department's part, and outside a state police officer that they also used to look at the case and said, hey, can you look this over for us? Like, are we missing something?
Right.
Their opinion, Paul Hull's opinion, ultimately my opinion is that, unfortunately she was driving while intoxicated and not clicked in. And if you know this patch of road, there is, it's in a turn. And if you fell asleep or you weren't paying attention, or possibly if you were very upset emotionally, which Jalea was, just minutes before her death is estimated to be, it would be easy at night in that dark turn to hit the guardrail.
Yeah.
And then the fact that she wasn't wearing a seatbelt and the only airbag to go off was the one to the left of her rib cage. So the one between the door and the driver's seat right there.
Yeah.
And I won't claim to know enough about airbags to know how much impact that would give you, but it could assist you to go out that passenger side window.
Yeah.
So that's the accident theory. And then we've got two, really there's kind of two theories for the foul play side. And it's one that Jalea was maliciously with intent struck with her own vehicle while she was acting as a pedestrian, by a young woman that she was with that night, named Kristen, who was the former sheriff's granddaughter.
Yeah.
That they had been in an altercation earlier in the evening, which there was some verbal stuff going on. I'll never deny that. There's a reason Jalea was upset, that she maliciously struck Jalea with her own vehicle while Jalea is outside of the vehicle and she is acting as the driver.
Yeah.
The second theory that some people think is possible, and this is one that I had leaned towards a lot, is that, you know, either Jalea was in the passenger seat and had actually been ejected that way, and Kristen was possibly acting as the operator of Jalea's vehicle.
Yeah.
Or that she had accidentally struck Jalea, that maybe, you know, they had hit the guardrail at one point earlier, they got out, and then Kristen accidentally struck her.
Yeah.
So
this next question, I just, you know, and you can answer this generally, or if you want to get specific, it's of course up to you, whatever you're comfortable with. But I sure. When you're investigating a case like this one, you start out sort of with this really, I mean,
bias.
A genuine thought of really not wanting to be biased, because you want to follow the evidence sort of wherever it leads, and wherever that walks you. I mean, that's kind of where you're going to go as you're investigating this. But
sure,
you know, it's almost impossible to make like that promise to yourself. Like, I'm going to stay very neutral the whole way, because eventually evidence is going to come out. You're going to walk a certain way and someone's not going to be happy. So, I mean, talk about that. Cause I know you've kind of touched on it now. Like, you know, some people love or hate the show. There's almost no gray with the show.
There's not.
And I think it's really fascinating. Tell me about it.
And this is obviously from my personal experience.
Sure.
And I've only done this one time, and I may only do this one time. So I think it's important that people understand, when I started this podcast, when I started researching this, when I started looking into all this, I mean, I jumped off a massive cliff of information, and I hate to say this case like ruined my life, but in a lot of ways, this case ruined my life.
I can understand.
I became completely obsessed with it and like consumed. My ex would listen to me in our bedroom, and I'm thinking, okay, if she was standing this way, what were the, you know, and I'm researching pedestrian injury patterns and physics and all of this stuff, you know, trying to understand how this could happen with some sort of intent and end up looking this way. That is a rookie mistake. And I will be the most humble first person to say, very novice, very rookie. You don't build the story to match the evidence. You let the evidence build the story of what happened.
Yeah.
And I was not doing that. It's very good to get Kim's side and the Davis's side of what may or may not have occurred that evening.
Right.
Absolutely. This is their loved one. This is, you know, that's Kim's daughter. Of course she has a right to investigate. Of course she has a right to want answers.
Yeah.
But I think that, and I know, and this is a discussion I had last night with my cop friend as well. I will never allow myself to get that emotionally involved with another victim's family.
Yeah.
People need to understand what you're seeing. Basically, the whole first season, or probably 90% of the first season of Mile Marker 181, is the Davis's side of what happened and their theories and their experience. And of course, I want to humanize Julia because that's who this is about and that's who we're seeking answers for, right? Like, if there was an injustice, we need to know that for Julia's sake and her family's sake.
Yeah.
But when you are only using one source of information, like the Kim Davis's side of the story.
Yeah.
That is a one-sided story. And I never seemed to have problems with this until I started exploring other angles of it.
Yeah.
And that's something I would never do again. Because I think I've learned my lesson on that one, right?
Yeah. Well, what you've kind of gone through and your perspective kind of as we stand, and we'll get into it a little bit more, but what's been the most difficult aspect of all this for you? I mean, you know, everything that's kind of the fallout surrounding the case and everything that's happened and everything on social media and all that stuff that's played out, you know, what's been the hardest part for you personally?
Personally? A lot. It hasn't been a good couple of months. So going into this, and I feel like I've been accused of calling people murderers or directly accusing people, which if you've listened to the podcast, I didn't want to get sued, right? So I'm very careful not to do that. But I feel a lot of personal responsibility and guilt for making those people's lives harder.
Yeah.
For approximately a year and a half. And as, you know, people continue to listen to the podcast and form their own opinions. And then when I come out with mine, you know, in the episode, in the update episode, in the episode with Paul Holes, some people's minds aren't going to change because I've built them up to that point where they are convinced that this is something more than an accident.
Right.
So there's a lot of guilt on that, especially since in January I reached out to one of the people that was named and accused and interviewed and, you know, all of this for 8 years, who's had, you know, a member of the victim's family show up on their doorstep and demand answers. I was not making their life easier. And as soon as, you know, I reached out and I said, hey, nice to meet you. You know, there's a Facebook message. Sorry that I made your life living hell for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So luckily, I have no idea. I don't think I could forgive somebody for something like that, but they were very gracious about it.
Yeah.
And I got to hear their side of events. And it was very enlightening. So, you know, the guilt that I feel for making these people's lives harder, you know, she was talking about moving away. The other girl was talking about changing her name, I think.
Yeah.
Those are like new developments since the podcast has come out. So there's obviously, I am personally responsible for that. The hardest part by far of this entire story, and you know, people are going to have their opinion of me.
Yeah.
I've got to like learn to accept that. People are going to think that I'm faking empathy or whatever. The hardest part of the entire thing has been like understanding mortality, and understanding consequences. And the other night, I had actually reached out to a friend who is a former investigator. And I was like, you know what? I'm actually really mad at Jahlia. So it's a lot of really weird emotions that come with, that come with dealing with a family this closely and then feeling like you've hurt them in some way.
Yeah.
But ultimately knowing that the person that's responsible, like for all of the years of pain and, complicated bereavement and all of these things, it's very, very hard to blame the victim, right?
Yeah.
Like no one wants to do that.
Right.
So it's been kind of grappling with, okay, this is the reality and no one in this story will ever win. Kim doesn't win. Jahlia doesn't win. Her sister doesn't win. None of the people that were named win. I don't win. The sheriff's department doesn't win. No one. And that's like something that I'm trying to actually like work through, is understanding that like I went into this so naive and Nancy Drew and gung ho about it, thinking that I was somehow going to change the case or find some piece of information that could get it reopened or bring the family some closure, and then resigning to the fact that I can't do those things.
Very well put.
It's not been fun.
Well, you know, one of the aspects of the investigation, you touched on sort of, you know, some of the theories and the kind of the idea of the accident versus foul play and everything. You mentioned, you know, roughly 90% of season one is sort of talking about, you know, the Davis side. And then there's sort of a switch when you're talking about what you personally believe. And that happens. I mean, I've been involved in stuff where it's like I start to believe one thing, or I'm working on one thing and I'm really going down a certain road, and then just like that, something happens and it's like, whoa, wait a minute, okay, now we got to go look at this might actually be what happened. I wanted to give you the con essentially, and just say, you know, talk about that change and talk about kind of what the root cause of that change was for you personally. What was it that made you decide, hey, there is no foul play here. This is most likely an accident.
This wasn't an overnight thing where I was like, holy crap, it's an accident.
Yeah.
This was months and months and months of, and I, you know, and I've said before, and Kim and I have talked about it as recently as, I'm trying to think, mid-June?
Yeah.
Where I said, you know, I go back and forth on this. I go back and forth on if it's an accident or not. And she said, yeah, but you have that right. You've looked at it. Because we were talking in response to some people online who simply haven't looked at the case.
Yeah.
And this is before she was posting documents and such. So, you know, they'd only seen like a limited amount of information. It was a process. So when I was reading through the book, I mean, to research this whole thing, there were times where I'd be like, I mean, I'm talking within the course of an hour, I'd be like, okay, wait, this is an accident. Okay, wait, no, this was obviously a murder.
Yeah.
Because you're with, you know, especially reading through that the first time, you're going, okay, stop, go.
Yeah.
With each new piece of information. I had reached out to Paul October of 2018 about looking at this for me, because I didn't know who else to reach out to.
Yeah.
So he sent me his PowerPoint, which is, I want to say, about 12 slides of photos that of the scene and the vehicle, none of the body, and said, okay, you know, hey, what do you see here? And he sent me back a PowerPoint with very, you know, pretty detailed and arrows and, you know, all kinds of stuff in there.
Yeah.
Of spatter analysis. So I kind of looked at that. I actually sent it to Kim and I was kind of like, okay, this is good to have. He's saying his professional opinion based on what he knows is that it's an accident.
Yeah.
And I had provided him everything, every bit of that case file, because I actually made a table of contents because I didn't want to waste his time. So I made him like a table of contents so that anything, you know, any forensic testing, anything like that, he could just run to that page of the PDF and look at it.
Yeah.
So, I basically like tucked that away, saved it, and was like, okay, this is good to have when I inevitably have to argue the accident side, and kind of went on my merry way. Yeah, probably not my best idea.
Yeah.
So it was May that I was recording for another project with him, another podcast. And, you know, after we were done recording for that podcast, I was talking about this case and I was like, you know, he was talking about, well, Emily, it's an accident. And I'm going, well, you don't have all the facts, Paul Holes. And saying, okay, but look at all this circumstantial stuff. Look at all this circumstantial stuff. And I'm naming, you know, all the things that everybody names when it comes to this case and theories and conflicts of interest. And he was like, okay, like, let me break it down like this. If you go out tomorrow and get killed, like, in a suspicious manner, they're going to look into every detail of your life.
Yeah.
Every little thing that happened in the hours leading up to your death, in the days, the weeks, everybody that you had a relationship with is going to be, you know, questioned, you know, when you're looking, like, essentially for motive. But that doesn't mean that it changes what actually happened.
Yeah.
So you can lift up those rocks and look and look and look, but circumstantial, it doesn't mean a lot.
That's a good point. And we've dealt with that a lot in some of the stuff we're doing. So I can understand kind of where you're coming from there.
That was more of an aha moment where I'm kind of like, okay, I should probably listen to this. There were still days where I was like, that guy's full of crap. Actually, and you're going to get some information nobody else has had yet. I actually had an incident where somebody that I know well went and talked to Kristen Bechtold and kind of got her statement on the whole thing. And then I'm hearing that, and this is not long after I had talked to Paul more in detail about the case and the scene. It was kind of like things piling up on me. I want to say the final like thing was more in August when I was kind of like, okay, this is like, for me, this is kind of like case closed maybe.
Yeah.
But I had already had some episodes like sketched out and continued with that. But if you listen to those, even there's a little bit more gray area where I'm like, okay, you're going to see a twist later, but like, yeah, a little bit more like, well, this wasn't handled this way, but it could just be because a witness statement isn't actually that accurate or reliable.
Yeah.
So stuff like that, where I'm kind of like getting ready to make that turn. But to be totally honest, it was October was like the worst month of my life. And because of all of this, or I'm going, okay, this is where I really actually had that moment where I'm like, I'm way in over my head.
Yeah.
I have built this up publicly and investigated it publicly. And I think a lot of people don't realize like the gaps in episode, this is like a real time thing. This isn't like a Netflix or like a Wondery production where you've got a team of people. I'm not Sarah Koenig, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, do you know what it is? It's me and a microphone and my MacBook and GarageBand, and no one else has ever touched any editing or script or research.
Yeah.
I realized that I was going to have to grow like a journalistic backbone and go like, hey guys, hold on.
Yeah.
And that preparing to do that actually took me a really long time, just emotionally, like psychologically. Because no one wants to be the person that says like, hey, I've investigated this and I know at points I agreed with what you had to say and I believed that this was a murder, but I don't believe that anymore. And I'm so sorry that this happened this way.
Yeah, that's very profound, I think. So I can certainly understand that position because I feel the same way with a lot of the stuff that we've done. It's not of the same serious nature. I mean, obviously lives were lost in our cases too, but it's one of the situations where nobody wants to admit they were wrong. Nobody wants to admit that, you know, some of these investigations that people have been working on, some of these for, you know, 3 or 4 decades of their life, to turn around and say, you know what, maybe I got it wrong. And it's, you know, 3 or 4 decades of my life. I have to admit now, nobody wants to make that move. Nobody wants to make that
no,
move,
it's,
you know,
and it's not been a good look for me, has it? but I think people also, like, that was a very hard thing. And it took me months to prepare myself for that, where I was literally having panic attacks about it.
Yeah.
Where I'm going, oh my God, how am I going to explain again to this person that this was an accident?
Yeah.
like how, you know, and especially after getting emotionally involved with them,
right,
and sympathizing with them and caring about them and genuinely, you know, like people can say what they want, but I really got into this because I thought that this was like a just cause and this was something that needed coverage and it needed to be out there because people needed to see that this was like a, possibly a cover up.
Yeah.
You know, I fully believe that. And I think that you can hear that.
Yeah.
So yeah, to do like a 180 and have to go, okay, well, you know, here's where I'm like maturing as a podcaster, reporter, whatever you want to call it, or an investigator, like we're going to follow physical evidence and we're going to follow like what logic and all the facts are truly pointing to. And we're not going to go based on hearsay or, you know, circumstantial.
Yeah. Good point. Do you think, you know, just kind of, as you're talking about that, I'm kind of thinking of kind of this idea, but I mean, do you think there's a trade that has to happen in order for a show of this genre, true crime, or just any specific genre to sort of, to get quote unquote big? Like, is there a sacrifice that the host has to make there? Is there a sacrifice that you have to make being that people are going to either be hardcore fans and love what you're doing and really support it, or they're going to be polar opposites of that? Like, do you have to make a sacrifice to, can you have both? I guess is the ultimate question there. Can you have a show like that that's not going to have detractors and not going to have people that hate on what you're doing or people that disagree with how you're doing it?
Well, I don't know that, Chris, I'm not sure I can handle that question because here's the reality is I'm too close to the situation. And like, I think people think that, for a lot of people, this is entertainment.
Yeah.
This was nothing about this was entertaining for me.
Yeah.
I mean, this was my life and continues to be my life, you know, going on 2 years now.
Yeah.
It's not entertainment to me. I'm a local here and like everybody, you know, when now I get recognized a lot and like people will want to talk to me about it and they're local people. And it's just like, I don't know. I forget sometimes that it's like a true crime. Like, I don't even want to call it a big show because I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
Like I don't feel like it is.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
For me, it's my project. It's the thing that I've been working on for 2 years, but I don't feel like there was definitely a significant moment where I had a shout out from a very large, like person in true crime and it hit 20 on iTunes.
Yeah.
And that's when I was going, oh, holy crap.
Yeah.
That was, I think like a year ago, maybe today actually, where, you know, I was getting ready to go to New York to record with, actually the pedophile's daughter. So I was boarding a plane and I'm going, holy shit, what is happening? There was definitely like a moment where like it felt big, but other than that, like this is just my daily life. So I don't know. As far as to answer your question about like people not, listen, I take that stuff way too personally.
Yeah.
There for a while, at the advice of a friend, just don't ever read the reviews, Emily, like don't do this, don't do that. And I was able to do that for a really long time. And then when I basically realized things were like getting a little heated is when I started looking.
Yeah.
And that was like the worst idea I've ever had.
It's very difficult. Don't do it. Yeah, no, it's very difficult I'm 100% with you on that.
Well, it's just, I think that people like need to realize I'm not like, to be quite frank, I don't even give a, am I allowed to cuss?
Absolutely. Go for it.
I don't give a shit about, and especially now more than ever, I don't give like an actual shit about being a personality in the true crime genre anymore. And I feel like this podcast has almost turned more into a society and culture piece, because we're dealing with themes of like complicated bereavement, PTSD, conspiracy theories, and also like death, like mortality. So I don't even know that it really falls into the true crime genre anymore. Obviously, like I have a big soft spot for that. I was raised on Forensic Files and Dateline and all of these things.
Sure.
To be honest, again, I don't really listen or watch any stuff anymore because when this gets to be your daily life, like I put on that 70s show now and working my way through that because I can't handle any more death. Right.
Yeah.
Unless it's work, like that's not fun for me.
Yeah.
That's not entertaining for me anymore.
Yeah.
So it just, I think that people also forget, like, I'm not an actress. I'm not like, I don't want to be a media personality, to be quite honest. Like, they can have it if they want it. But it's just totally inappropriate the way that we treat people. And I've seen this a lot with the ladies from My Favorite Murder, where people just, everything they say, like, it's never going to be satisfactory, right? Everything you say when you put yourself out there as a content creator or whatever it is you're doing, you are like putting your balls on the line, and to have people attack you personally over like I've seen on Reddit where people are talking about me getting a divorce. People are talking about my boob job. I'm like, are we, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of left like a bad taste in my mouth, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it gets real personal real fast. And I get that. I mean, I can totally empathize 100% because I'm in the same thing. I mean, not again, different, a little bit different genre, but I'm in the same thing basically.
And if you removed like the host from the show and the content stayed the same, like there wouldn't be all of that like vitriol out there.
Yeah.
There would be like honest criticism, but you know, people talking about they want to punch me in the face because they don't like my voice or something. I'm just like, well, go do a podcast.
Yeah,
you
that's really ridiculous though. Yeah, I think that's
And we all face that. It's just been extra heated for me lately, but we all face that. Yeah. And I just think that's like, people got to get a grip on reality there. Like, I'm very much a normal girl from this area, and that's why I was so like threw myself into this.
Yeah.
I didn't know that it was going to take off in any matter. I thought maybe just like my friends list would listen on Facebook.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody feels that way. I think everybody can, unless you're with a big, you know, like you said, a big conglomerate or a big company that produces podcasts. Nobody ever thinks their shows, I mean, they want it to, you know, they want attention on the show and on the case that they're investigating, especially if it's true crime, because that's why they're doing it. But, you know, that no one ever expects it to get huge or blow up beyond, you know, a few thousand listens a show. That would be a huge success, you know, and I think in most small time podcasters' eyes. I mean, I certainly was for us, for sure. I mean, when we started doing what we were doing, so. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I hit like 10,000 subscribers and I was like, oh my God. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
It was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it would become, you described like a big show.
Right. Yeah.
If you want to call it that. Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, did you get a chance to, if you didn't, that's totally okay. But did you get a chance to listen or watch the Mile Higher show? Like, did you watch it? What did you think of it?
No disrespect to them. It's not even like, that was not what that verbal reaction was. I did not know it was coming out. So I got on Twitter and was like tagged in a tweet, like in response to that. And when I saw it, I'm pretty sure my heart like fell out my butt.
Yeah.
I was like instantly nauseous. I was sitting at my favorite diner and I'm just like, I'm pretty sure I probably just went pale as a ghost. So I can't remember if I watched a little bit of it in the diner and then I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this at all. Especially like, and we all make like I was talking about earlier with Danielle's video, we all make like little tiny errors. There were like a couple little things like that where it wasn't factually like where we're calling it Parkersburg police and it's actually the Wood County Sheriff's Office, little things like that.
Yeah.
But like when this is your whole life for 2 years and that's your area and you have friends that are Parkersburg police cops and you don't want them to like be getting flack from an online community that doesn't even realize that's not the agency that investigated it.
Yeah.
You know, I was like literally getting nauseous. I think it was the next day I tried to watch it again in my bed and I just was like bawling my eyes out.
Yeah.
Well, I've put a video on Facebook, so it's not a secret. I didn't, you know, I'd been accused of sending them a screenshot or approaching them for them to make this video. Like that was not the case. I had posted back in January. It's been like 2 months now. I had received like a vague threat from the victim's mother online. And I posted that to my private and personal Facebook, which I don't even have 600 people on that friends list. Like it's my personal Facebook page. It's not like a business thing. And it was shared by a friend off of my friends list with Kendall Ray, who does Mile Higher. You know, I wasn't asked for comment. I wasn't given like a heads up that was going to be thrown in there. So I'm watching and that screenshot pops up and I'm just like, Oh my God.
Yeah.
Great. Awesome. Because I think, you know, and I've tried to reach out to her. I haven't had a response back. I'm like, I don't think you understand that this is where I live.
Yeah.
There's a history of issues here with assault or confrontation. And I, you know, it's very realistic that I will run into somebody who is related or somebody who follows the Justice for Julia page, and we'll have to like have a confrontation.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that just wasn't taken into consideration. And the reason I shared that privately, if I had wanted it to be public, I would have put it out there publicly.
Yeah.
And I've done things like that before if I want them to be public. But it was more of a thing so that my friends and family in the area, understood like the severity of the situation.
Yeah.
So that I just, that honestly, it just really hurt.
Yeah. Well, sort of transitioning out tonight, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of people asked me to ask you about the future of the show. So, I mean, I want to be able to at least say, you know, hey, I did definitely ask her about it. Are there going to be more episodes?
Yes,
will there be more?
There will be more episodes. I had an interview that was set up for Wednesday to talk essentially about PTSD and complicated bereavement and the things that happen when you lose a loved one, or when you come up on a scene as an officer, as a family member of the deceased, as a witness. You know, we've got two other drivers pulling up and seeing this in detail. You know, you've got one driver actually hitting Julia's body after she's deceased.
Yeah.
The things that come along with that. And they took a look at the Justice for Julia page and backed out of the interview because they didn't want to face targeted harassment, essentially.
Yeah.
They didn't want to have to go on there and look and see like, well, this person doesn't know what they're talking about type of stuff. So,
gotcha.
And I understand that. Like, I respect that decision. It just really sucks when you're trying to like finish a project and do it justice and do it right. Mm. But I want to talk about, you know, the things that go along with like losing a loved one, or the things that as an officer, you know, you're handling scenes like this regularly, you know, and that adds up.
Yeah.
But there's also another case that was kind of similar in the situation as far as underage people being killed, vehicular accident that was caused by alcohol consumption.
Yeah.
And it was the same agency, some of the same deputies, and it was handled entirely differently, like polar opposite. You know, charges were brought for involuntary manslaughter and furnishing liquor. And it was just like, okay, well, why wasn't this handled that way? If it's not a homicide, why wasn't it handled this way?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the route that we're going. I don't want to say we're taking the focus away from Julia. Really, we're bringing it around to like the actual reason, why was there no justice in this situation?
Yeah.
If there was justice to be had, why was no one charged with furnishing liquor or involuntary manslaughter charges?
All right. So I know we've covered a lot of your really in-depth stuff tonight. It's been a deep sort of a conversation, and I appreciate you doing it. Before we get out here tonight, I wanted to have a little fun. So before I kind of get to this next part though, there's something we do with every guest. It's something we've done like actually the last several episodes. Did you ever watch the show Inside the Actor's Studio?
I've seen some of it. Yeah.
Okay. So have you ever heard or seen the like the questionnaire stuff he does with everybody that sits on the show at the end? Like he asks them a list of 10 questions at the end, and they just kind of answer like a rapid fire thing. You ever heard that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, we're gonna do it. It's a lot of fun, and it's just kind of like a little quick thing we do to kind of wrap up for the night. And we did this with Mike Boudet and with Rob Christofferson and a bunch of other people. So we'll do it with you.
Okay.
Just give me the first kind of thing that comes to your mind. First question: What's your favorite word?
Incognito.
That's a great one. I love
it. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay. What's your least favorite word?
A lot of people have a problem with moist. Mine isn't that. I don't. I'm sure I have one, but I can't think of anything.
Moist is, I think, I think it's the number one.
Like for a lot of people, I don't have a problem with that word. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's funny. Okay. What turns you on?
When you say that, I automatically think sexually.
I know. I feel like if people aren't familiar with that show and like, you know, the manner in which he asks the questions, it's not, it's more like what, you know, like what turns you on, like intelligent, yeah, like, you know, things like that in it.
Oh, well, yeah, that was going to say like intelligent people, a really good conversation. Like when you can talk to somebody like about aliens or murder or like what type of condiments are best, like that will get like my brain juices flowing. Like I love a good conversation.
Awesome. So what about the opposite of that? What turns you off?
I just hate, like, I hate bigotry. I hate, like, I actually really, and this is something I'm learning, I really hate when people are convinced that they are like the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
Or that they know everything. They know everything. I'm like, none of us know anything and we're all just floating around.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
That's kind of just like, I don't even want to say like pseudo intelligence, but rather people that don't realize that they're being ignorant.
That's a good one. What sound or noise do you love?
Right now I'm like, the sound of crickets has come back at my house. The sound of crickets, and also, right now I have on fake nails too. And like the clacking of fake nails, yeah, like on a surface. Yes.
Yeah. My wife would agree with that.
Yes.
What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
I think we all hate like nails on a chalkboard. I hate anything like, and this is like a texture thing too, is like chalk.
Mm.
So even like when you're writing with chalk on a sidewalk, like that sound that it makes.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. I can't do it.
Now, this is everyone's favorite question, and it's a fun one. What is your favorite curse word?
I think I've got to go with shit probably. really, it's the F word I use it the most, but like, If I have to pick like a solid, if I could only use one for the rest of my life, I'd pick shit.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite too. Okay, so what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Well, so this is like funny because this is actually, I'm switching kind of, I don't know if you want to call Mile Marker 181 a career. it doesn't feel like one. I didn't intend for it to be one. I'm actually applying for police academy.
Oh, congratulations. That's very admirable.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I am ready to like get my hands literally dirty.
Yeah.
And get, you know, like be the first person to arrive on the scene, like that type of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess that, but I always wanted to be like a criminal profiler.
Yeah.
I think that's a very common thing within the true crime genre.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so what profession would you not like to attempt?
Anything, and this is funny because I used to be a nanny, but like anything, any child care, any daycare, teaching small children,
yeah,
like anything under sixth grade, like I could never.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a hard one. Yeah. It's a hard profession for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, the last one, maybe the most profound, but it's a great way to end every show. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
That all my dogs are there, obviously. Every dog I've ever owned, every dog I've ever known is there.
That might be the best. That might be the best answer we've ever gotten. Beautiful.
Yeah. If my dog, I don't want to be there if my dogs aren't there.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% agree with that. Okay. So Emily, please give a plug to the show so that folks can, I mean, I know people are going to do the Google thing that haven't listened to the show. They're going to probably, I mean, people typically do when they're listening to our show, we get some feedback. People are like, oh, I Google as soon as I'm listening to your show as the guests are talking stuff. But I encourage everyone hearing this now, go check out the show, listen to the entire run thus far so that you can sort of gain the entire perspective. So can you tell everyone where they can hear Mile Marker 181?
Sure. It's on iTunes. It's on in the Google Play Store, Spotify, Stitcher. And I feel like I'm missing one more. A lot of it, I've got a couple episodes yet to upload, but it's also on YouTube as well.
I got to tell you, I enjoyed this. I know it's not easy to come on and continue to put yourself out there. I appreciate you allowing me to spend a little time with you tonight. So it's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
Yeah. No, thank you for having me. I feel like this has actually been like a little bit spiritually cleansing for me because no one has actually like in a formal setting, you know, I talk about this with my own personal friends. I've talked about this with Paul, you know, since all of the backlash and all of like, a lot of people like to call it drama.
Yeah.
But nobody's actually like had the balls to ask me to come on and answer the questions for myself. People just want to assume. So I appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed it. It was very nice.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle Me My Friends Pod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle at Me and My Friends Pod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. This episode of the podcast featured the original track, Blue, by producer Redeman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.